Big news. One generous Marketplace fan, Dr. Joe Rush from Florida, is offering to match the next $50,000 in donations to Marketplace. And every single gift gets us closer to a critically important May fundraising goal. So please give right now and double your impact thanks to this generous match. Go to marketplace.org/donate.
How being black in America can affect where you live and what kind of water you drink. Plus, whiskey fungus. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, D.C., I'm Kimberly Adams in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, the 19th of June. It's good to have you along on this Juneteenth. In every month so far this year, home builders have become more optimistic about the market for new houses. That's according to a survey out this morning from the National Association of Home Builders. It seems that buyers are adjusting to higher mortgage rates, and new homes are playing a bigger role in the housing market more generally. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes starts us off.
Alicia Huey builds custom houses in Birmingham, Alabama. She says one thing that makes her feel good about the market for new homes compared to this time last year is that it's easier to get the materials to build them. She's also learned to order appliances she needs as soon as she starts putting up 2x4s.
The last house that I just finished, we had to order garage doors as soon as we started framing.
Which, she says, didn't used to be the norm. Huey is also chairman of the National Association of Home Builders and says there's clear demand for these new homes, especially as high interest rates have kept owners of existing homes from selling. Now, NAHB chief economist Robert Dietz says new construction makes up a much bigger chunk of the housing stock for sale.
Typically, it was about 12%, so roughly about 1 out of 10 homes being new. Today, it's 1 out of 3.
Getting more housing inventory on the market is key to controlling the price of shelter overall. Both owner-occupied and rental housing has gone up 8% in the past year. Realtor.com chief economist Danielle Hale says increased construction could help, depending on what gets built.
Especially if builders try to meet the needs of not just trade-up buyers, but more entry-level buyers.
But Hale points out the prices of both labor and supplies remain high, and it's historically been more profitable to build fancier houses for people who can pay more than to build starter homes that are more affordable. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
Stock markets are closed today for the holiday, but capitalism never takes a day off. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Staying on the housing beat, as of 2021, more than 70% of white households in America owned a home. For black households, only around 44%, according to the National Association of Realtors. The black home ownership rate actually ticked up a bit during the first 2 years of the pandemic. At the time, mortgage rates were near historic lows. But since the Fed started raising rates, that momentum is slowing. Marketplace's Matt Levin reports.
The foreclosure crisis of the late 2000s hit black households especially hard. After reaching a peak in 2005, black home ownership dropped and stagnated. But in 2020, those numbers started creeping up, says Zhang Choi at the Urban Institute.
There has been an increased share of younger black homeowners during this period. In 2021, about 54% of black home buyers were below age 45.
Historically low mortgage rates lifted home ownership across racial and ethnic groups, but since 2021, mortgage rates have more than doubled. Choi says that's especially hard on black home buyers, who on average have less cash on hand for large down payments.
Those who put lower down payment are more sensitive to rate changes, so we would think that on average, black home buyers are more sensitive than white.
Homeownership data for last year isn't out just yet, but George Washington University Business School professor Vanessa Perry fears what a prolonged period of higher rates could mean for black homeownership and wealth building.
To the extent that black households are not homeowner households, that is the driver behind the colossal wealth gap.
And while mortgage rates have shot up, housing prices aren't tumbling down. Brian Green at the National Association of Realtors says if he could choose any one policy to fix the racial homeownership gap,
building several million new houses throughout the United States.
Green says that in the long run, boosting supply is the only way homeownership becomes more attainable for more Black Americans. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
Racial inequality shows up in many forms and places in the U.S., including in the water. Flint, Michigan, and Jackson, Mississippi are just two examples of poisoned water in predominantly Black communities. The Biden administration has earmarked more than $50 billion to replace lead pipes and build new water treatment plants, but a federal report found we actually need more than $470 billion to maintain and improve drinking water infrastructure over the next 20 years. Adam Mahoney is a national climate and environment reporter with Capital B, a nonprofit news organization that focuses on Black voices and communities. He went on a reporting trip through parts of the South that have been hit the hardest by water access issues. Adam, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So tell me about some of these places you visited.
Yeah, it was kind of a personal project for me in many regards. So my grandparents are from the South, and I stopped in their communities first. So Beaumont, Texas, which is home to the seventh largest oil refinery in the entire world. And then I also stopped in Opelousas, Louisiana, where my grandmother was born. And then we focused on other bigger cities throughout the region. So like Charles, Louisiana, in addition to Jackson, Mississippi, and then Memphis, Tennessee.
Can you give a sense of scale in terms of how many people are being affected by these kinds of water crises that you describe?
Yeah, I mean, when we look at our water infrastructure system, there are thousands of failing water plants and cities, communities that are dealing with outdated water lines, dealing with lead water lines. So it's a widespread issue. When I was traveling throughout the South, I visited 11 cities. Every single city had water problems, had recently had a water boil notice within the last year, had reported having brown water trickling through their faucets. So this is something that is widespread, and it is found at every level from rural to urban.
So the through line in this piece is that clean and consistent water access across the South in these Black communities in particular is bad. But the reasons are pretty varied. What were some of the reasons in these different communities?
So really, this project broke it down into three major parts: the way that climate change has been impacting the water crisis, our dependence on the fossil fuel industry, in addition to the infrastructure crisis. You know, infrastructure improvements, while, you know, they're super important, they don't necessarily get to the core of the crisis. Water, which is a life-sustaining thing, right? We need it, you know, literally to live. If it has been contaminated for so long, even when it does become, you know, clear per se, there's still that element of, can I trust it?
One reason you point out for how it got so bad is the way that we as a country fund water systems has changed in the last few decades. What happened?
Over the last 50 years, the federal funding of local water systems has declined by something, you know, close to 75-85%. And it was really accelerated and spurred by a change in the 1980s, which switched federal support for water projects at the local level from a grant system to loans, and city budgets are just not that large. They didn't have the funds to consistently upgrade infrastructure.
So how did it end up that so much of these problematic water systems tend to be in predominantly Black communities?
I mean, I think it goes back to residential segregation, redlining, and just the fact that, you know, Black and brown folks, low-income people have been relegated to be concentrated in our country's toxic corridors, the places that don't have, you know, financial support, the places where these industrial companies set up business and have been polluting for decades.
You know, you're
talking sort of big picture there, but as you said, when we first got started, your family's from some of these places. Like, the more you learned about how bad the water was in some of these communities, how did that make you feel when you know that it was your own family drinking it?
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely a difficult trip, and it was eye-opening for me, right? I didn't necessarily make all the connections between water contamination and a lot of the different social ills that are impacting communities. So in Opelousas, where my grandmother was born, has the third highest rate of poverty in Louisiana. It also has the second highest rate of gun violence. And folks there were making the connections between water contamination and gun violence. You know, different studies have shown that water contamination, particularly when we're thinking about lead poisoning, how that affects mood, thought processing, and cognitive development. So all of these things feed into each other and interact in a way that we don't necessarily think about, even though we are facing these forms of violence.
Did you have any moments on your trip where you saw something or someone working to address this issue and you really thought, that's it, that's how we fix this?
Yeah, I mean, I can highlight Opelousas. I spoke to a couple there that over the last couple of years, they've used their voice in activism. But what I thought was really amazing about their approach was that it was community-centered. I think when we focus on these big picture issues, right, that have these multi-billion dollar price tags, it gets very daunting. But when you start at the local level, when you start with your neighbors and your community, it becomes easier. So really that ground-up approach that I saw all throughout the South, not only in Opelousas, was really exciting and meaningful to me.
Adam Mahoney is a national climate and environment reporter with Capital B. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
According to Pew Research, in 28 states and here in the District of Columbia, Juneteenth is not just a federal holiday, but a state one as well, with state and local government offices closed and state employees getting a paid day off. Of course, many workers in the private sector are also off today, which for some is an opportunity for self-care, perhaps with the help of products from Black-owned businesses. With that in mind, we decided to check back in with Kalina Bruce of Noir Lux Candle Company in Seattle, Washington.
Business is going really well. We just celebrated our one-year anniversary of being in business. We are kind of at our slow season in terms of people coming into the shop, but we're getting a lot of orders for wholesale, bulk, and private labels. So that's been really exciting. The great thing is that we have been able to get things quicker and things have been more accessible than they were in the past. With the pandemic, it was really hard to like order something and get it within a timely manner. Or a lot of times things that you're used to ordering, like you found that one thing that's great and it works really great with your brand, and then that whole thing is out of stock and you can't get it anymore. And I think that we're kind of turning a corner of being able to have more access to those things that we've been used to getting. We have been invited to participate in a couple of local Juneteenth events. We have some candles that just like celebrate Juneteenth and the emancipation and just provide a little bit of like context and history about the true meaning of Juneteenth. As a Black business owner, it's really cool to be able to not only, you know, bring a unique activity, but often I'm asked to share a little bit about my story or my journey or my background. And so I get to facilitate conversations while baking candles. So, you know, my background was in education and I was really kind of sad to, you know, leave that space and start a new one. But I actually get to bring the space with me, and that's been really cool too.
Kalina Bruce, owner of Noir Lux Candle Company in Seattle, Washington. We can't do this series without you, so let us know what's going on in your economy at marketplace.org/myeconomy. Coming up,
we're going to have less coffee.
Gonna have some grumpy people, but first, let's do the numbers. U.S. markets are closed today in observance of Juneteenth, but let's take a look at some more Black-owned businesses. According to the census, there are 3,455,000 of them in the U.S., with receipts of $83.6 billion. That's 12.7% of all businesses in the country. Let's look at how some publicly traded Black-owned businesses ended last week. In hospitality, RLJ Lodging Trust, with 97 hotels in 23 states, lost 0.7%. In banking, Carver Bank Corp. fell 2.5%. Citizens Bank Shares Corporation lifted 1.6%. And in healthcare, American Shared Hospital Services was down 0.7%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Big news! One generous Marketplace fan, Dr. Joe Rush from Florida, is offering to match the next $50,000 in donations to Marketplace. And every single gift gets us closer to a critically important May fundraising goal. So please, give right now and double your impact thanks to this generous match. Go to marketplace.org/donate. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams. So this weekend, I went to a bourbon blending class, packed with dads who got the opportunity as a gift for Father's Day. And it makes sense as a gift. Whiskey is now one of the top-selling spirits in the U.S., and a large part of that growth comes from Jack Daniel's. Last year, the company reported a 20% increase in sales of its signature Tennessee liquor. For one rural town, a side effect of the whiskey boom has been whiskey fungus. Back in the day, government agents used to track illegal moonshine production by searching for whiskey fungus. But today, it's causing headaches for business owners and nearby residents. From Tennessee, WPLN's Caroline Eggers has more.
On a recent humid afternoon, Patrick Long fires up a pressure washer at his family business. It's a wedding venue in Mulberry, Tennessee, a picturesque white mansion, manicured landscaping, and a sprawling green lawn. Long says the entire place routinely gets covered in black, crusty whiskey fungus.
The only way we get it off the house or the structures is with a chemical base, so it's 50% bleach, 50% water.
From his property, he can see one of the newest warehouses built by Jack Daniel's. Each warehouse can hold tens of thousands of wooden barrels full of aging whiskey. And as it ages, whiskey slowly emits ethanol into the air. That's what the whiskey fungus eats. Long has to power wash his venue every few months to get rid of the fungus, and he hires help.
I can't just squirt a pressure washer up on a 30-foot roof.
And within a few months, the fungus is back. And Long says people don't want to get married at a venue covered in black mold.
Number one, my business has been destroyed. And number two, there's nothing I can do about it. And now our property is worth considerably less than probably what we paid for it.
Up close, whiskey fungus looks soft, almost powdery. But it's really hard to remove. it has this microscopic super glue. It clings to roofs, windows, even stainless steel. The fungus is not known to harm humans. The spores aren't airborne like many fungi.
You don't see a lot of cells of this thing represented in the air.
University of Toronto mycologist James Scott says there's very little research on whiskey fungus.
It's very understudied, and almost anything that you can learn about it, whether you're a professional or an amateur, is new information.
We don't know much about how it spreads, but scientists can point to at least one potential culprit, snails.
Snails seem to really like eating this stuff.
The fungus is not unique to Tennessee. Spores are all over the world. But the black crust only seems to sprout up next to distilleries and bakeries. To stop its spread, Vanderbilt University mycologist Antonis Rokas says,
the only way to eliminate the black fungus from the area would be to somehow filter the ethanol.
That's standard practice for big brandy distillers in California. Tennessee doesn't require ethanol filtration systems, and Jack Daniel's says it isn't voluntarily planning on installing them. A single unit can cost several $100,000. In a statement, the company said air filters would affect the taste of its product, but did not explain how. Jack Daniel's declined to provide an interview. Back at the manor, Patrick Long says the fungus has killed off much of his and his neighbor's landscaping. He runs his hand along the branches of a bush that's completely coated in black. Some of the branches are so brittle they snap like potato chips with light contact.
If you go up there and put your fingers on it, it just cakes off in your hand. You can pretty much fill your hand up with it.
Landscaping is pretty crucial for a wedding business. And Long says there are no temporary fixes. It's not like he can power wash plants or trees. In Mulberry, Tennessee, I'm Caroline Eggers for Marketplace.
From a drink to mellow you out to one that wakes you up. Some folks start the day down at the local coffee shop, others craft theirs at home. I'm a tea drinker myself, but coffee is obviously a big deal here in America, and it's pretty popular around the world. But the coffee we're drinking could soon start to taste a bit different, the BBC's Katie Barnfield reports.
The US is the second biggest importer of coffee in the world, with $680 million worth brought in last year, according to the global trade research company, the Observatory of Economic Complexity. With numbers like that, it may be hard to believe, but the coffee market is fighting for survival. Martin Kinyua is from the Mutira Farmers Cooperative in central Kenya. He says climate change is damaging crops of traditional beans like Arabica and Robusta.
You cannot say when the short rains are coming, and that means that the quality and the quantity of coffee is affected.
The Fair Trade Foundation works to support coffee farmers around the world. Eleanor Deans is its sustainable sourcing manager.
By 2050, as much as 50% of the global surface area currently used for coffee farming will no longer be suitable.
Dr. Aaron Davis, a leading coffee expert in London, agrees the industry is reaching crisis point.
We're already seeing the influence of extreme weather on coffee production. We need additional coffee crop species that are able to grow under altered conditions.
He says if we don't adapt,
we're going to have less coffee, prices will go up, which is unfortunate for us as consumers. But I think the real hit and the real jeopardy is for farmers.
The coffee industry is now turning to a different, tougher type of bean called Liberica, which is mainly grown in the Philippines. One place that serves it is Romulo Cafe in West London. The owner is Chris Joseph.
When we were growing up in the Philippines, we drank Barako coffee, which was a mix of Liberica and Arabica. Liberica is sweetish.
Some of the big players in the coffee industry, like the global importer Volcafé, are now investing in these beans. Hannah Rizki is global head of research there. She says the industry has to persuade farmers to make the switch.
It's up to us to give them a price incentive to try these new varieties and to try and adapt to these new varieties. Without the farmers, we won't have a cup of coffee, but we also won't have a business.
She says companies need help to convince farmers to switch crops. She wants
governments to get involved and promote different varieties.
Eleanor Deans from the Fair Trade Foundation is warning the solution isn't that simple. She says farmers are also struggling with inflation and skyrocketing production costs and aren't getting a fair price for their crops, which means time is running out to safeguard the future of coffee farming.
Parents in these coffee communities often are encouraging their sons and daughters to move out of coffee because they don't see a future there.
Volcafé says it expects global stocks of coffee to fall to record lows in 2023. So as well as having to get used to coffee tasting differently, we might also find our caffeine hits are in shorter supply. I'm the BBC's Katie Barnfield for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, with Father's Day yesterday, a quick look at time off for new fathers in the U.S. According to Axios, 11 states have gender-neutral paid parental leave. Another 6 have laws granting parental leave, but those laws haven't kicked in yet. 25% of workers in the U.S. have access to any kind of paid family leave, but 11% of workers can't even take unpaid leave to have a new kid. Here's your moment of economic context, climate change edition. Global warming has opened up more of the Arctic for trade and tourism. The U.S. will have its first deep water port in the Arctic in Nome, Alaska, once a more than $600 million expansion of the existing port on Alaska's western coast is completed. The new port will be able to host bigger cargo ships, an expanded military presence, and cruise ships of up to 4,000 passengers, so tourists can get an up-close and personal view of the consequences of climate change. Our daily production team includes Livy Burdett, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Nicholas Giang, Maria Hollenhorst, Sarah Leeson, and Sean McHenry. I'm Kimberly Adams. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.